From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, police in Cambodia arrested the former second-in-command of the Khmer Rouge, the brutal communist regime that ruled Cambodia between April 1975 and January 1979. Some accuse Nguyen Chia, known as Brother Number Two, of being even more responsible than Pol Pot for the estimated 1.7 million deaths that occurred under the Khmer Rouge. Chia had been living free in a wooden house near the Thai border, but the 82-year-old will now be tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity by UN-backed tribunals. This may seem like a historic opportunity to reckon with the atrocities that have scarred so many Cambodians, but as Megan Williams reported earlier this year, the younger generation is not so eager to confront the bloody legacy of the Khmer Rouge or the hell their parents endured.
On the raised wooden veranda of a small home perched on stilts, the women of Muang Vang sit and talk about the past. Muang Vang is in central Cambodia, a tiny village just off a red clay road where palm trees shoot high into the sky. Ko Yin holds her infant grandchild in her arms. This 58-year-old was in her late 20s when Pol Pot took power. By the time the regime fell, her sister, brother, and husband were all dead, killed by the Khmer Rouge. Her two oldest children survived. The third, the same age as the child she now holds, died in her arms of starvation. Ko Yin is painfully aware that her older grandchildren don't believe her story.
They say, "How is it possible that you ate so little?" They say they haven't seen it with their own eyes, so they don't believe it when I tell them there was so little food, that we worked so hard, that people were killed. I'm angry they don't believe.
It's a grievance many survivors of the Pol Pot regime express. In Cambodia, there's been little public discussion of the genocide. Even after the regime fell, leaders still held key positions in government. Others, including Pol Pot, have died without facing justice. There's a real risk, say people like Vishwa Moili, that the country's brutal past is in danger of being denied or forgotten by the next generation.
I heard that you work in the field, rice field, and you got a lot of rice, so why you didn't have enough rice to eat? Like, it's very abstract when my parents told me.
Vishwa's 21 and works with the Phnom Penh group called the KRT, short for Khmer Rouge Tribunal Outreach Program. She and her colleague Nu Va spent 6 months traveling the country, interviewing young people about the Pol Pot past. They came out with a documentary called Seeing Proof. The film includes archival footage and interviews with survivors and their children. Throughout, teenagers express their doubts about the genocide.
I think it's hard to believe because they don't understand how Cambodians can kill each other. We are all good people and we have feelings. Why would they kill each other?
If there was such a regime, why didn't the people stand up and fight back against the leaders? They let a handful of people kill millions just like that?
Nu Va says high school students get taught practically no history of that time period, and for kids in the countryside, information is even scarcer.
Some of them don't go to school, and now we don't have much about the Khmer Rouge regime lesson.
Nu Va and Vishwa are traveling around Cambodia again, this time to show the film. Vishwa says people sit in silence and then ask to see it again.
Especially the older generation, they came up to say their past experience, they cried, and the little girl come up and cried as well, and just cried and said, "She's very, very sorry to their old generation."
Across the city, two young radio hosts broadcast their weekly shows from the Women's Media Center. 27-year-old Dina Chap hosts the Road of Law program, a call-in show that focuses on issues related to the upcoming Khmer Rouge Tribunal. It receives no government funding and struggles to keep on air with grants from foreign human rights groups. Dina says she uses different elements to trigger memories like this old Khmer Rouge propaganda music.
I start by playing the music and the, in the Pol Pot regime, and then ask to the young people and ask to the old people also, do you remember this song? Because I choose the popular song that in the Pol Pot regime always play in the morning.
Another radio program called The Truth aims to present nonpartisan information about the past in a way the government has failed to provide. It also offers an outlet to callers still suffering from that past.
The person who call in our program, most of them is the survivor of the Khmer Rouge regime. But however, we try to attract young people to listen to our program. Personal stories, this is what young people want to hear.
It's with us, with every day, and not a single day that we forget to condemn the regime, that we forget to tell the children. It's been with us. It's a living history.
Yuk Chang is often a guest host on The Truth. He's the director of the Documentation Center of Cambodia and the nation's most vocal advocate for the victims of the Khmer Rouge regime. He's just finished the first textbook entry on the Khmer Rouge, and once approved by the government, it will at last become part of official history. He says that what always comes up when he hosts a show is how everyone, survivors and killers, feel victimized by the past.
So one time I was in between one killer and one victim from the same prison, and I was in the middle. When everybody, it doesn't matter they were perpetrator or victim, when they talk about food, they all cry.
Food,
it's so emotional. And people began to cry, and it just, and both sides, between even the killer, they feel that I was so hungry too. I would kill people because I want to eat food.
This mournful ballad is about Tu Slang, the infamous prison in Phnom Penh where 14,000 children, men and women, were tortured under the regime. Their pictures line the walls, staring out into the former classrooms where they were held. The rooms have been left almost untouched, torture instruments sitting on bed frames, chains still bolted into the floors, bloodstains on the walls. As a final chapter of the Seeing Proof documentary, a group of high school students is shepherded through the former prison, the first glimpse at evidence of the Khmer Rouge terror. A survivor explains that children were killed along with their parents, a favorite Khmer Rouge motto being, to clear the grass, you must dig up the roots. The teens' faces show shock and distress. Vuk Chang says that while it's tough for kids to face what happened, it's also what his country needs to finally heal.
It's just like a medicine. You know, it, to me, it's the most effective reconciliation process of all. Having children knowing so about what happened to their parent, I think it's the best healing. It's the best healing among all other processes that I have seen in Cambodia. It's the best healing. You know, the kids were just so happy that the kid went to the museum and tell them the story. They're so happy. They were so happy.
For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
President Bush has not forgotten the agony of Cambodia.
In Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge began a murderous rule in which hundreds of thousands of Cambodians died by starvation and torture and execution.
In his speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Kansas City last month, President Bush invoked Cambodia to justify staying the course in Iraq. But that was hardly the only historical analogy the president lobbed in the VFW hall. He embraced the whole panoply of Asian conflicts.
The militarists of Japan and the communists in Korea and Vietnam were driven by a merciless vision for the proper ordering of humanity. They killed Americans because we stood in the way of their attempt to force their ideology on others. Today, the names and places have changed, but the fundamental character of the struggle has not changed.
But the president seemed to like the Vietnam analogy best and was quick to note he wasn't the only one.
In a letter to Al-Qaeda's chief of operations in Iraq, Zawahiri pointed, and quote, to the aftermath of the collapse of American power in Vietnam and how they ran and left their agents.
Oppose the war and America and her friends suffer and die. That's the lesson of Vietnam, as taught by George W. Bush and Zawahiri. According to Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, it's also the lesson of Munich. And last year in Essence magazine, Condoleezza Rice drew an analogy between today's anti-war activists and those who oppose the Civil War. They just didn't hate slavery enough. It's all in the syllabus for the White House course on historical analogies, taught by a parade of politicians and pundits. Apparently, it's a prerequisite for patriotism. But real historians will tell you when they get the floor, pretty crowded these days, that historical analogies employed for political ends by any and every administration are invariably steaming piles of revisionism. President Johnson invoked Munich prior to escalation in Vietnam. And like President Bush last week, Johnson also used the example of Korea to justify a prolonged military presence. But there are no real analogies. Every event is specific, subject to timing, personalities, even weather, not to mention the distortions inherent in textbooks and the passage of time. The late, great American commentator Gerald W. Johnson once said, "Nothing changes more constantly than the past, for the past that influences our lives does not consist of what actually happened, but of what men believed happened." Or what men would have liked to have happened. Historical analogies are all those things and more, but they can never show us a true picture of the present, and they can never, ever show us a clear path to the future. This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you were one of the 227,000 paying subscribers to the New York Times online service called Time Select, well, you are no more. Paying, that is. Initiated 2 years ago, Time Select placed online access to some content, notably op-ed columns, behind a paywall. But very early Wednesday morning, you received an email, mine began, "Dear Home Delivery Subscriber," informing you that the paywall would be dismantled, effective immediately. Those emails were signed by NYTimes.com General Manager Vivian Schiller, who says there were two main reasons for the change. First, millions of people now use sites like Google News to look for information on the web, and if you charge for content, those millions of people can't find you or your ads.
But in addition to that, in the last 2 years, we ourselves dramatically improved something that is called SEO, search engine optimization. And that's basically what you do with the data around your articles, the metadata, and the way that you tag your articles so that search engines can find them. So as a result of improvements in search engine optimizations, our articles rank much, much higher than they ever did before. And in fact, our overall audience, just as a result of our SEO, has grown in the last 2 years by 133%.
Now, some of your big-time op-ed columnists, Nick Kristof, Thomas Friedman, I think Maureen Dowd, spoke out publicly against the paywall, saying in effect that it was alienating too many readers.
Yeah, Tom Friedman in particular was vocal and was concerned about losing a lot of his international readers who wouldn't have access to Time Select and would be cut off from his content. And certainly we were unhappy that they were unhappy about that. And of course, we want our columnists to be read by the largest audience around the world as possible. But at the end of the day, this was a business decision.
And in addition to liberating the op-ed columnists, you've also freed up much of the archives. So I have to assume you crunched those numbers and figured out that selling ads on old articles was more lucrative than charging readers for them.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've opened up two huge chunks of our archive. The first is 1987 to the present, which really accounts for the bulk of what people look for the last 20 years. But we've also opened up our archive from 1851, which was when the New York Times was founded, to 1922. Why 1922? That was the last year before copyright laws went into effect. So in fact, 1851 to 1922, which has got a lot of cool stuff, including coverage of the Civil War and the Titanic, is now available for free because it belongs to the public. It's the public domain.
And in between 1922 and 87?
And in between, some of that is available for free, like our movie reviews. We've opened all of that up for free. The rest of it is something that our readers can buy either in a single or multi-article pack.
Have you come to the conclusion that paywalls just don't work? I mean, we've heard rumors that Rupert Murdoch is thinking of taking down the paywall around the Wall Street Journal online.
Yeah, that's true. And we're very flattered that he's looking to follow our lead.
Has he sent you flowers?
Yes, yes. I'm still waiting for those flowers to come. They're not quite here yet. You know, I think for certain niche publishers, perhaps a paywall still works. Sites that, you know, have real-time financial data. I know ESPN has some pay services, and those seem to work for them.
Did it occur to you that there are just certain things that people won't want to pay for? I mean, people will pay for porn, but they won't pay for Thomas Friedman.
I just want to dispute that because actually people did pay for it. We had close to 750,000 Time Select subscribers, but 225,000 of them paid us. Time Select did work. However, in the long haul, just the growth of advertising revenue versus the kind of single-digit growth that we would find in subscription revenue is going to keep us in business longer so that we can keep hiring more reporters and keep covering news of the world.
You know, some people who predicted the end of Time Select are now celebrating, in a sense. For example, Jeff Jarvis, who blogs at Buzz Machine, wrote this week, and I quote, "It was a cynical act doomed from the start. With it goes any hope of charging for content online. Content is now and forever free."
Yeah, we love Jeff. Jeff has been honest about Time Select for a while, and that's fine. I wouldn't call it cynical. I think on the contrary, we believe strongly in our social mission. You know, we have bureaus all over the world. We have the largest presence in Baghdad. How can we continue to support that kind of journalism if we can't pay it? This is not cynicism. This is about pursuing that journalistic mission.
You know, someone on our staff is now thinking of dropping his subscription because he can read the Times entirely online.
Well, yes, and there may be some that do that, but you know what? We can't force behavior on people. We have to provide our content in the way that consumers want it. And if we lose a newspaper subscription, then so be it. But you can't force change. You can't work against the tide.
Vivian, thank you very much.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
Vivian Schiller is Senior Vice President and General Manager of NYTimes.com.
With the end of the Time Select experiment, the paper would seem to be placing more and more importance on web advertising. While still only a minor fraction of advertising budgets, many believe it will someday be the cure for all of those ailing news outlets we're always talking about. But that remedy hinges on one pretty basic assumption, that web users can actually see the ads. New software, most notably Adblock Plus, a free plugin for the Firefox web browser, makes virtually all ads on your screen disappear. When we huddled around an office computer checking it out, our staff gasped as web pages loaded seamlessly, not just with no ads, but with no indication that the ads were ever there in the first place. The plugins work on most every site, from the New York Times to NPR to CNET, where Declan McCullough wrote about this issue. Declan, welcome back to On the Media.
My pleasure.
There have been many, many surveys done which suggest that users, especially young users, believe not just that spam is spam, but that all advertising is spam, and they have the right to delete it.
I think among some of the younger crowd, there is this idea that advertisements somehow really ruin the web browsing experience, and that they also slow down the web browsing experience because your computer has to send a separate connection to download that ad. And if it's a video ad or a flash ad, it can actually take some time.
Apart from consumer desires and system utility, this also raises a couple of legal questions. When you sign on to use a website, in many cases, you as a user actually agree not to interfere with the advertising process.
That's right. Certainly not all websites do this, but MySpace.com does, the Chicago Sun-Times does, other news organizations do. And those terms of service agreements tend to say you can't do anything that blocks or covers our advertisements. And the second legal theory that anyone bringing suit against the ad blockers would use is one that says you can't create derivative works by blocking our ads and essentially modifying our content. This is what the entertainment industry used in the late 1970s in its lawsuit against the VCR. And the trial judge considered it but rejected it, saying that, well, only 25% of VCR owners fast forward through commercials and so on. But what's interesting is that it was based on the state of the art technology at the time and what happens if 95% of people did. And so there are some more recent legal opinions suggesting that courts might go the other way if that question were presented to them today.
Well, let's just say that everybody who is using ad blocking software is committing a tiny, tiny, tiny little financial crime. What about the manufacturer of the ad blocker software? Is there any legal liability attendant to giving me the tools with which to commit the crime?
Unlike burglary tools, this is computer code, and computer code is what someone has written, and so there's a First Amendment analysis there. But I can see some courts saying, you know, sorry, this is designed for one and only one thing, and that's to block ads, and may not be that appropriate. The problem is this software is out there on servers all over the world, and so there's not much in practice they can do, so it's probably a better dispute to be resolved by technology. The website detects the ads aren't being shown. Well, then you don't see the content.
Well, you raise an interesting point. Can websites eventually defeat the ad blocking software?
Right now, websites have not taken steps to either detect the ad blockers or to thwart the ad blockers, but it is possible. I mean, one thing that you can do is instead of serving ads from a domain called doubleclick.net, which is very popular and very easy to block, you can instead serve them from the organization's own website. And so that's going to be more tricky for ad blockers to block. Maybe they can come up with a countermeasure, and maybe the web publisher can come up with a countermeasure. And so I see that sort of technological arms race as being at least as important as the legal question.
Well, you know, there's, a more basic question, which is that if you're using an internet site and the site is dependent on advertising for its revenue and you obliterate the advertising, isn't that sort of stealing?
It's very close to it. There is a slight additional incremental cost every time someone connects to a website. It's a small amount of money, but when you have millions of people, and this is the case today, using ad blocking software, it can add up. So you're essentially trying to get something for nothing, and the morality of that just seems a little squirrely. I mean, if you don't want to see ads, maybe a better way to do it would be paid ad-free versions. Another way to do it would be to say, here's an ad, I'm going to wait 30 seconds before giving you the content. And news.com has a relationship with Lexis. I mean, they brand a certain portion of our website, and it's very difficult to block that sort of branding, and it's also probably less intrusive. Otherwise, right now, if you want the website content, then you have to look at the ads. You're getting it for free, don't complain.
Well, Declan, I just want to point out that this conversation will be on the air and also on our podcast, which, of course, is subsidized by underwriters. And there is no way in the world, if you download our podcast, to obliterate their message. Declan, I appreciate your help.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Declan McCullough is chief political correspondent for CNET News.
Mi cámara usa Energizer E² Lithium. Así puedo inmortalizar muchos más momentos.
If you didn't understand that ad for Energizer batteries, you actually are increasingly alone. In the spot, a man who's discovered he's immortal tries to find batteries that are up to the challenge of life without end. It's just one ad in a sea of pitches to Spanish-speaking consumers. And here's why. An estimated $928 billion will be spent this year by those consumers in America. That's $200 billion more than just 2 years ago. And Spanish language TV, magazines, and radio are all growing in tandem with that market. It's a boom, and with it comes advertising that is more nuanced, funnier, and truer to the experience of being a Spanish-speaking consumer in America. Cynthia Gorney got the lay of the land from John Gallegos, who runs the award-winning ad agency Grupo Gallegos, and she writes about it in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. Cynthia, welcome to OTM.
Pleasure to be here, Brooke.
The main ad guy in your story, John Gallegos, talks about, essentially, I don't remember the word in Spanish, I'm ashamed to say, the grandma ads, where if you wanted to sell...
Abuelita.
If you wanted to sell a product, grandma would be there. He says he loves his grandma, but it's a very boring thing to use the family-centered approach every time. Hispanics aren't just about family.
I heard a lot of ad people actually in Hispanic advertising talk about abuelita advertising. And what they mean by that is whatever your product, you figure out how to sell it in a scenario where there's a happy multi-generational family and there's abuelita looking beatific in the corner and she's pouring the milk or she's using the product or she's looking on as the kids use the product. And that's how you signal this is a real Latino family. But if you stick to those cliches and assume that Latinos somehow aren't sophisticated enough to get the kind of humor that makes ads memorable and funny in other languages, your advertising becomes boring and you don't sell the product very well.
So how has the latest generation of publicistas like John Gallegos updated the approach? I mean, you wrote about how a simple translation of the famous Got Milk ad wouldn't work for a number of reasons.
Well, the people that I talked to and spent time with at the Gallegos agency, their attitude was just, look, we can't use Got Milk for a variety of reasons. Number one, Got Milk translates literally into Spanish as tiene leche, which may or may not be a somewhat obscene thing to say to someone, depending on the context and the countries that they're from. More to the point, they said, look, that very famous campaign in which they made humor out of people not having milk in their refrigerators, they called it shorthand the deprivation campaign, isn't funny for a lot of the people that we're trying to reach. The notion of deprivation being funny doesn't resonate very well with somebody who's just struggled to get across the border and is struggling to make ends meet here. They tested it out in focus groups, and people were like, what do you mean? We don't have milk, and that's funny. It's not clear to us. So they went on the opposite end. They did a very funny campaign about people who have been drinking so much milk that they have excessive amounts of bone strength and hair flexibility. It's a visually very amusing campaign that goes off on a completely different tangent. And their tagline is, toma leche, have some milk.
I was fascinated with how you divided the Latino community, this market, into essentially three groups. There were learners, there were straddlers, and there were navigators. And I guess different pitches would be designed for each of those groups.
Each agency has a different way of splitting these people up. But what the Gallegos people call learners are those who have been in this country less than half of their lives, for example. They use Spanish much more comfortably than English. They are still basically learning how to function comfortably and fully in English-speaking American society. How you might market to learners, you might use, for example, sort of winking or more open references to the fact that they're just here. There was an ad I saw for beer that grabbed me because what happens in the ad is that a very hardworking, clean-cut, good-looking guy whose name is Basilio is walking around his neighborhood. And all these people from different ethnic groups are trying to be really nice to them, and none of them can pronounce his name. And they say, hey, oh, Basil, hi, Basolo. And then he goes into the bar. It's a Tecate beer ad, right? So he goes into the bar, and everybody hoists their Tecate beer, and they start talking to him in Spanish, and everybody can pronounce his name right. That's an ad aimed at people for whom being new in this country is a big part of what they experience on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And it is a way for the Tecate company or the advertiser to say, we get it. That's what any advertiser does, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the navigators, you might have an ad that uses a lot of English. You might have an ad that appeals much more to the fact that, yeah, we know you live in a really nice community. You have a gardener. You want to drive a really fancy car, but you're a Latino guy also. And so we're going to somehow connect these messages into one ad for you.
What led you to write about this subject now?
The truth is that I actually started watching a lot of TV in Spanish a few years ago. You would think reading news articles that a person who has come here who either is undocumented or is not yet really comfortable in English might have a complex or a scared look at the country around them. And the more I started watching the American world as it appeared in advertising, it looked to me just relentlessly upbeat. What you see and what you hear is a country that is welcoming, that is upwardly mobile, where kids have cell phones and homemakers make meals in sparkling suburban kitchens. I really had no idea of the breadth and complexity involved in this portion of American advertising, the sheer growth numbers. And when I learned how huge they were, the entire nature of the very noisy immigration debate began to look somewhat different to me, because there's a huge part of the American economy, as we know, that thrives on this constant immigration and on this rapidly expanding consumer and workforce. And at the same time, on one hand, that we're carrying on about needing to limit it and needing to make all these restrictions on the border, we have a whole chunk of our economy that not only depends on it, but is growing rapidly because of it.
Cynthia, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Cynthia Gorney's article, How Do You Say Got Milk on Español, is in this weekend's New York Times Magazine.
Coming up, how classical music fans fell for a musician who really was too good to be true.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield, with a brief update on Rathergate. Having been a high-profile fall guy in CBS News' dubious reporting on the president's National Guard service, former anchor Dan Rather filed a $70 million lawsuit Wednesday. He claims to have been unfairly maligned by his former network, which he claims was pressured by the White House to make an example of him. The controversial report, which aired 3 years ago this month, hinged on an apparently forged memo presented by CBS News as a smoking gun. Now another major network has been embarrassed by a fraudulent document, this one the extravagantly padded resume of an ABC News consultant. The man is Alexis DeBott. Among other fabrications, he claimed to be a PhD, and isn't, and to have interviewed Barack Obama, but didn't. Laura Rosen of Mother Jones Magazine has helped expose DeBott, and she says that getting discovered didn't cause DeBott to fess up.
He says that in the case of Barack Obama, he met a guy named Rob Sherman from the Chicago area, that he paid Rob Sherman $500 to conduct the interview with Barack Obama for him, that Rob Sherman sent him the interview and DeBott translated it into French and sent that into Politique Internationale. I called Rob Sherman in Chicago, who has an AM radio show there, and he does not know DeBott. He has indeed interviewed Barack Obama, and I and others have been unable to locate the Rob Sherman that DeBott provided us the telephone number and address for.
Rue 89, the French publication, discovered that his credential, his PhD, which he puts on his business card and puts in all of his emails and so forth, was conferred by an institution. Which one was it?
Well, he'd told different things to different people, but he had put in writing to a scholar at a think tank in town that he had a PhD from the Sorbonne. When the story initially broke, he claimed that it was an administrative mistake on his part, that he had done all the work and just not realized that he hadn't got the actual stamp. But in fact, he would have to have known that he was nowhere near completing his PhD from the Sorbonne. This reporter for ABC had been hearing there was this annotated CV in town, obtained the CV, and gave it to her boss at ABC. And that is what led to someone walking into Brian Ross's office at ABC, shutting the door and saying, we have a DeBott problem.
Now, there is one story that is particularly sensitive, and that concerns Pakistani militants who were involved in cross-border skirmishes with Iran. What was the essence of that story that ABC reported? And to what extent was DeBott in the middle of it?
In the spring, ABC reported, largely based on DeBott's reporting from Pakistan, that the U.S. has been encouraging and advising this Iranian ethnic minority group called the Jandullah to attack the Tehran regime. another producer who went for another network to talk to the actual leader of the group that Debat claimed was getting U.S. support. The leader is a guy named Rigi, and Rigi claims that he has gotten no such support. And in fact, he tried to lodge a complaint against ABC when he heard about this report. And in fact, today I obtained a letter that the Iranian Foreign Affairs Ministry sent to the United Nations after this ABC report, saying it's proof that the U.S. is trying to destabilize the Iranian regime.
I want to get back to Debat's resume, how all of these various organizations, from the Nixon Center to ABC News to even the Pentagon, for whom he was working on a consulting basis, could be so taken in. It turns out that they all say the same thing. They were all impressed with his resume, and it never occurred to them that anyone with so many affiliations could be a fraud.
I think it was those other affiliations more than his actual paper CV itself that gave people confidence that he was who he says he was. In fact, you know, someone in his world emailed me today that, you know, in our world, you just don't misrepresent your credentials because one assumes you're going to get caught. I will also say that it's possible that Debat faked some things and told the truth on others. And what happens when your credibility gets hurt like this is that it's very hard to know what's real and what's not.
Now, you've actually talked to this guy. What does he have to say?
I haven't talked to him by phone since this whole thing broke. We've had a couple encounters in the past in this small world. He's been pretty adamant in his written communications to this policy community that we operate in that the only thing he did wrong was getting this alleged Rob Sherman to do the Barack interview and by misunderstanding what his CV is. In other words, he still wants there to be plausible deniability.
Getting less plausible all the time, I'd say. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Laura Rosen is the national security correspondent for Mother Jones magazine. When ABC News learned of Debat's bogus PhD last May, the network swiftly fired him. It also scrutinized the stories on which Debat had served as a source, but did not find any inaccuracies. This week, in response to news that Debat faked not just his credentials but entire interviews, ABC has opened a second, more extensive investigation into all the stories he touched. But unlike the New York Times after Jason Blair or USA Today after Jack Kelly, ABC is working internally and has no plans for an outside investigation. Jeffrey Schneider is Senior Vice President and spokesman for ABC News. He says his company is determined to get to the bottom of the Debat problem.
I can understand why people might want a third party to look at these things, and it's impossible for me at this point to say whether that would be something that could happen. I do, however, have great confidence in our ability to, I think, answer these questions to the satisfaction of ourselves and to our audience.
Now, other news organizations, when they discover that they have a liar in their ranks, there at some point tends to be disclosure to the audience. In what form has your disclosure taken place?
At the time that we demanded his resignation, you know, we did not, you know, ring the bell loudly. Obviously, against the backdrop of these outright fabrications, you would say, you know, how could ABC not have stood up and said very loudly, you know, this guy lied on his resume? All I can tell you is at the time, we felt that demanding his resignation and getting it was appropriate.
Now, there's one particularly sensitive story I want to ask you about in which Debat played a role, and that was the report that Pakistani militants who had been involved in cross-border skirmishes in Iran had been, quote, secretly encouraged and advised by American officials. A story that suggests that at least by 1 or 2 degrees of separation, the United States is involved in trying to overthrow a government.
You know, that is a story that we worked on for several months, 5 or 6 months is my understanding. Debat's information was a piece of that story, but by no means did the story stand on Debat's information. We have very good sources, both in European and U.S. intelligence and governments. You know, at the end of the day, we want to be the first to report that there's a problem with that story. So far, through the 2 reviews we've done, we don't find that problem, but we sure are looking hard.
You know, in the end, Jeffrey, I suppose it's very hard for any news organization to protect itself against a liar. What will you do in the future in the hiring of consultants and maybe just reporters and producers as well to make sure that their resumes actually hold up and that they are what they claim to be?
You're right, Bob. If somebody is willing to lie to your face, that does create a difficult situation. It's also complicated by the fact that time and again, he had good information. And not only did he have good information, occasionally he would stand in the way of our other reporting saying, you know, I know that's not the case. Don't report that. Particularly, there was the issue of this terrorist, Rahman, being taken into custody, supposedly, and Debat waved us off the story. And some weeks later, after we had actually reported that this guy was in custody, it became clear that he was not in custody. You know, he clearly did lie and was a liar about many things, and yet he did provide solid information that other sources were happy to confirm. It's really appalling and tragic, and, you know, at the same time, it's a pretty interesting story that we want to get to the bottom of.
All right, Jeffrey, thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Take care.
Jeffrey Schneider is the Senior Vice President and Spokesman for ABC News.
And now, another faker. For classical music fans in the late 90s, it seemed almost too good to be true. A virtuoso pianist with a compelling history emerging seemingly from nowhere. But what began as a topic in internet chat rooms became a global phenomenon when tastemakers like Gramophone and the Boston Globe weighed in, the Globe calling her, quote, the greatest living pianist that almost no one has ever heard of. In June of 2006, Joyce Hatto died at the height of her fame. But then in February of this year came the news that her bio was not real and her recordings, some 100 of them, not hers. Her husband, manager, and co-conspirator William Barrington Coop was left to try and explain. Mark Singer recently recounted Hatto's so-called brilliant career in The New Yorker.
Well, Joyce Hatto had a real career as a pianist, as a soloist. She played recitals in London in the 50s and 60s, a middling sort of career, no great distinction, and then disappeared. She doesn't really reemerge until the 1990s. And at that point, very indirectly, through recordings that are issued by Concert Artists, which is William Barrington Coop's label, they were at first talked about very quietly in some internet groups. And there were little excerpts from these CDs that were uploaded, and people were hearing them. They weren't really being marketed aggressively at all, but the word of mouth spread through the internet.
Let's talk about the role of the internet in all of this. It seems as if she couldn't have taken off like the phenomenon she was if it hadn't been for the communities that coalesced around her recordings online.
I cannot imagine this having happened in a pre-internet age. I think she and her husband both recognized that there was this virtual world that where they could influence opinion about her, and they did it in very targeted ways. They would see who was communicating in these chat rooms. They would get in touch with them and then strike up a conversation, in effect, through email. Every time she would issue a new CD, there would be a new buzz on the internet about these things, and there would be a few detractors, but mostly people were pushing her because she wasn't getting recognition in the world outside the internet yet.
What was her breakout number?
Well, there was a recording of a Liszt piece, Mephisto Waltz, that was posted on one website that a lot of people fell in love with. You're asking actually the question du jour, because the artist on that recording has just been discovered within the last 24 hours. But for a long time, that wasn't the relevant question. It was, this is Joyce Hatto. Have you heard her?
And those of us outside the online classical world might have first heard of her when the classical music press jumped on the bandwagon. You note in your piece that there are a couple of embarrassing moments.
The major publication in the classical music world is the Gramophone. And they hadn't published any reviews of her work until, I think, 2005, and then reviewed her in every issue. And there was one example of a very distinguished critic who reviewed one of her CDs of a Rachmaninoff concerto and described it glowingly. And it was discovered after the hoax was exposed that he had reviewed the same music, the literal same performance by the artist who was plagiarized quite unfavorably 15 years earlier.
What were the elements of Hatto's story and repertoire that appealed particularly to classical music aficionados?
I think the fact that she was a woman in her 70s who was recording this really extraordinary range of music that one doesn't normally assume one pianist can master. Concert artists issued under her name 100 CDs. There was the fact that it was discovered at a certain point that she had retired from concert performance because she had cancer. It was just a romantic story. For example, there are these accounts of her having toured in Poland and in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and there's no documentation. But the reason this Khan was such a wonderful work of art in and of itself was because Barrington Koop produced translations, both in Swedish and Russian and in English, reviews of these performances that she might never have performed. And there was another thing that went into this, which was there was a fictitious conductor and orchestra that Barrington Koop invented, René Kohler and the National Symphony Philharmonic Orchestra.
A Holocaust survivor?
Who not only was a Holocaust survivor, but then spent 25 years in the Gulag. He gets captured by the Russians after he somehow survives Treblinka. This was someone who never existed, but Barrington Koop created an entire biography for him. And because it was a Holocaust survivor, how was anybody going to challenge that?
The same kind of cold-hearted person that would attack a woman suffering from cancer. And I guess that leads to the next question. There were some skeptics fairly early on. Why weren't they heeded?
There was one in particular, Peter Lemkin was the name of the agnostic, a German conservatory graduate who did ask those questions, but when the hoax was really exposed, it wasn't because of Lemkin, it was because of technology. Someone in New York took a Joyce Hatto CD, put it in his computer to download it into his iPod, and was told, yes, this is Liszt's Transcendental Studies, but it's not Joyce Hatto playing, it's someone else, Laszlo Simon. So he went to Amazon, and he started listening to what he had downloaded from this CD and what Amazon had available, and he said, my gosh, this is the same exact performance. Then there was a perfect storm happening, actually, because there was another group of people in London who were analyzing some other recordings, and they discovered that there were two Chopin mazurkas that were ostensibly Hatto. There were, in fact, another pianist.
You tracked down the hoaxer. Barrington Koop himself seems to have been an odd sort of guy, cheerful and apparently completely unwilling to recognize that he's committed such a elaborate fraud.
William Barrington Koop is a con man. Con artists are charming people. You can look this up in the DSM and you can ask yourself where does the line from, you know, sociopathy stop and some other syndrome kicks in. I'm not able to diagnose what he has, but he does believe that he can charm you, and he doesn't seem to really care too much about the consequences either. And in that sense, he's right. There hasn't been any consequence for him other than that his name is ruined. Nobody's going to sue him. And the reason they're not going to sue him, by the way, is because you have to prove damages. And Laszlo Simon perhaps sold 50 CDs the year before the hoax was exposed. And then it's exposed and people say, wow, that guy's great. And so they go out and they buy his CDs. So rather than having been damaged, he's actually benefited.
Are we all susceptible to really good narratives? Is that why the skeptics didn't really get the floor for so long?
I am susceptible to good narratives, and this had a lot of people wanting this to be true. In fact, Brian Ventura, who is the fellow in Westchester County who discovered this, said to me, even when I realized what had happened, that she had probably plagiarized this recording, I didn't want to bring this story down. It was such a wonderful story.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Mark Singer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. As he mentioned earlier in the interview, Hatto's breakout performance, Liszt's Mephisto Waltz, has just been properly identified. It was actually performed by Janina Fialkowska.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Rob Christensen. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.